Blog Talk Radio.
Geeks are back on the air after a 10-day hiatus.
10 days.
Welcome.
Took the world.
That's right. They really were eventful days.
Yeah, they were, really. We go away and everything starts to happen. I mean
everything goes to hell.
I mean, dude, just everything. Robert McNamara. You know, Oscar Mayer died today.
Oh, did he really?
Yes. I mean, everyone's dropping like flies now. I mean, just
Wow. Everything.
It's all going down, man. But we're back on the air. So
yeah,
regardless of what happens, you know, hey, we're back, and this is where you need to be.
You always wonder if when we take a break like this, do we still know how to do it?
Are you kidding? Every time we go on, I forget how to do it. I usually need to have a couple of drinks before I go on, but never on a Wednesday night.
Yeah, it's only been 10 days, but, you know, there it is.
It feels like an eternity.
Welcome, everyone. We're going to talk movies tonight, like we do every night on this show, but we're going to start out with an interview segment, and this is really Jeremy Renner. He is one of the great actors of his generation, and
mm-hmm.
you know, we know this from watching movies like Dahmer and 28 Weeks Later and,
mm-hmm.
and The Assassination of Jesse James and a lot of the other great films and roles he's been a part of. But I think the world is going to find out in a big way with The Hurt Locker, which is his new movie. It's about EOD, people that disarm bombs in war zones, and this happens to take place in Iraq. And it's been deemed one of the best Iraq films ever made.
I think that's definitely what I've heard. I also think because of Catherine Bigelow, she took the politics out of it.
Yes.
And that might have been the key all along to really making a movie that's going to reach to everyone. And sounds like she did it.
It works on a purely thriller level.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very thrilling, edge-of-your-seat movie. And it's anchored. Everyone is very good in the movie. And some extraordinary actors pop up. Anthony Mackie and David Morse and Ralph Fiennes. But it's anchored by this amazing performance by Jeremy Renner, and any review you read of this movie singles out his performance, and
right.
he is, among actors, he is a front runner for a nomination for this film, which we actually talk about in the interview, and it's interesting. I haven't told you, Jerry, how this interview started.
Okay, well, I think. Do you want to surprise me, or?
Yeah, well, it's not part of the interview.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it was the whole, I answered the phone, we said hello, and then a male voice in the background said, come back to bed, Jeremy. And Jeremy started laughing, and he said, that's my buddy Sam Rockwell, he's trying to crack me up. As I thought that was great.
Oh, my God, you had both of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God. Okay.
So that was funny. But here's our conversation with Jeremy Renner about Catherine Bigelow's The Hurt Locker, which opens in wider release this Friday. When you got this script, because I know Catherine Bigelow really wanted you for it. When you got the script, did it scare you?
Scare me? Not at all. I had a very violent reaction, but a strong reaction after I read it. Normally, I can't get 20 pages in without falling asleep. This one, I went front to back and then wrote, you know, 3 pages of answers and questions because I was so curious. And I waited to get on the phone with Catherine.
Yeah.
I wasn't afraid at all. I mean, it was just something I knew I couldn't wait to do. I was shooting actually 28 weeks later at the time. Mm-hmm. I was in London. And I really just wanted to start working on, you know, James.
Well,
I was so enamored with it.
The reason why I asked you that is because, I mean, looking at your work and the characters you choose to play, you seem to be so fearless as an actor, and you tend to gravitate towards very complex and oftentimes kind of contradictory characters. And I'm curious what the appeal of James was to you.
Well, that would be that. Complex. If it's almost three-dimensional on the page, I mean, it makes my job easier, but also that I loved, you know, to me, that's the enjoyment of acting, is that I get to learn and grow and feel like I have something to offer. I don't know, I don't want to be bored when I go to work.
Mm-hmm.
I want to discover. The discoveries that I have when I get the chance to work is the most amazing payoff. As far as it being fearless, I don't know if I'm maybe, but it's not about being afraid or not, or being courageous. It's just I have a very strong reaction to, I guess, like you said, complicated roles. They just really interest me. I like, you know, anti-heroes especially. I like flawed characters because to me it's realistic.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I'm pretty good at basing characters in truth because that's all I have as an actor. And, you know, this particular role, I couldn't have been more excited to do it. And still, when people ask me questions about it, it's I don't have all the answers. And I'm totally okay with that.
Yeah. Well, that's important too, because a lot of times I hear actors say, and directors, that when you're building a character or building a piece, it's important to ask questions, and a lot of times it's more important to ask them than to answer them.
Yes.
What does that mean to you?
I don't think you have to have all the answers, but for James, I think every question I asked, I had I had answers. I just had to. Some of them were big character traits that I had to really focus on.
Mm-hmm.
First question I asked Catherine was, how do you want people to feel, the audience, that is, when they come out of this movie? As, you know, James is walking into the sunset with his bomb suit back on, how do you want people to feel as a director?
Mm-hmm.
And she answered it to me. It's pretty much what I thought and probably what people will feel. And that gave me the building blocks of, like, okay, this is what this character is. Da, 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 da. I went on and on from there and just started building.
Yeah. I know that every role is different, but with this one, mm-hmm. was there an aha moment, like a key word or a concept that kind of unlocked it for you?
There are a few things. It was the bomb suit informed me a lot. Physically about the character. Music informed me a lot. That informed me about music on top of it, which gives me a certain emotional fuel. Moments like with the Beckham, the kid in the movie.
Yeah.
That informed me a lot of who James was. Having a child and wife back home, what that relationship was, informed me a lot. And probably... the bump, I really was adamant about those. It was just kind of written as like this parts under my bed, and it became very important to me that I actually collected those, and it became out of respect for the bomb maker. Then it added, I think, a really interesting aspect to the character versus just collecting trophies to it being a chess game, and out of respect, it just deepened the character instead of, you know, being bravado, which is too one note for me. So those sort of moments really help me define who the character was.
Well, I know you spent a lot of time actually talking to the EOD guys and going through some level of training with them, so your performance would be authentic in that respect. But they volunteer for this yes. job. It can't be something as simple as an adrenaline rush that it gives them. What makes up
no.
these men?
Yeah, I think that's a cheap, easy way to go.
Yeah,
I think it's really cheap. You know, I think why these guys do what they do is there's different reasons. You know, to be honest, some were like a pay grade. Some were just like want to do something different than just be a soldier. Or some, but what all EOD has is I guess what was really telling for me is what they do afterwards. Really, because some of them really couldn't define why they were doing it, but they become civil servants. There's something very gratifying about knowing what you do in life affects people. And if you do it selfishly, if you do it because whatever the reasons why they do it, there's still something very gratifying about it. So, and they're all so smart. It's the opposite of really what the opposite of my character. But my character isn't the average EOD guy. So,
right, your character's reckless.
A lot of the stuff that they would tell me I couldn't really use. And then teaching me all the rules, and like, well, my character doesn't follow any of the rules. So I had to learn all the rules so I knew how to break them.
Right.
And so on and so forth. So, I mean, a lot of it was very informative, and they gave me so much, but I could only go off of, maybe 50% of what they were giving me.
You're the guy in the flaming car, Sergeant James? Afternoon, sir. Yes, sir. You're a wild man, you know that? Huh?
Yes,
sir. He's a wild man, you know that? Huh? Why don't you shake your hand?
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. How many bombs have you disarmed?
I'm not quite sure, sir.
Sergeant.
Yes.
I asked your question.
873. Yeah, counting today, sir, yes.
That's got to be a record. What's the best way to go about disarming one of these things?
The way you don't die, sir.
That's a good one. I spoke like a wild man. That's good.
The role is very physical, and I'm sure that's a lot of what you picked up from them. And I was reading an interview with Ms. Bigelow, and she was talking about the first part of training for you involved moving 200 paper clips.
Oh yeah, the stack, that was part of the bomb suit training, which is you put the suit on and which people kept telling me how heavy it was and how difficult it was to move around and the whole thing, and they put it on me. I'm like, oh, it wasn't so bad. I started doing jumbo jacks. I'm like, heck, I can handle this, and then not realizing, that like, here's a stack of paper clips, and all I got to do is get on the ground, pick one up, get up, walk over 10 feet back down the ground and just move the stack essentially. And then after about 10 paper clips, I wanted to pass out. I'm like, okay, this isn't as easy as I thought it was going to be. And then, half hour later, after, dragging a bot like 300 meters and, digging out a 155, which is about 50 to 75 pounds, and dragging that, it was arduous. It's the physical part, and that's the easy part, is the physical. It's the mental thing that got really crazy. You dumb down about 25, 30 IQ points. Because by the end of all the physical training in the suit for about 45 minutes, you take the suit off and you do simple division on the chalkboard, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't. 7 goes into 49, and thinking like I want a sandwich. That's my answer. I can't do it. It was and what's interesting too, because the physical part was physical, but these guys, I met a guy who did four tours, and this guy had a big beer belly, completely out of shape, but he had, it's mental toughness that these guys have.
Yeah,
laser focus that, geez, any physical, the guy I trained with, don't get me wrong, he was built like a linebacker and, probably 2% body fat. But then there were other guys that were like, 5'2", wearing glasses, probably weighed 120. The suit weighed as much as they did, but could still do it. And it's a mental that takes over.
Any of those guys that you collaborated with, have they seen the movie? And if they have, what are their thoughts on it?
I do not know. That's a really good question. I would love to know, and I would love to talk to them about it.
Yeah.
I certainly hope they're happy. I know Captain has done some screenings for EOD. I just talked to a kid that's going into the Navy EOD, being shipped out here in a month, and he really enjoyed it. But I really, really care about the guys I trained with.
Yeah.
Hopefully I make them happy, because that's really important to us.
Tell me about the environment you're working in, because you shot in, I believe, Amman, Jordan, and you're
shot
not
Amman, Jordan, yeah.
Not too far at times from the conflict in Iraq, the war in Iraq.
Yeah. Well, sometimes we're like 3 kilometers from the Iraqi border. But, I mean, it didn't feel any more safe or less safe than, I don't know, if we're in Bakersfield, I suppose. I mean, that didn't really come into play. But the landscape certainly made it easy for us to feel like we were there and we were in it. I mean, really, to be honest with you, because of shooting in Jordan, which this movie would not turned out if we did not shoot there, it's to me another character in the movie, a big character.
It really is.
To me, there was no acting in the movie. It was all reacting to what our environment was. At the time, we didn't know if the people, the sets were a square mile sometimes. There were just people wandering around, cats, goats, camels. We'd have no idea. Is this part of the movie? Is this not? We never saw a camera as far as they were hidden up on top of a building. Rarely would see Catherine at times, and it felt like we're doing a little plays each week.
Yeah.
And, so we just had to react with what was given to us. And we trained, or I was so fortunate to train for nearly a year prior to shooting principal photography. And so I felt like, just kind of throw whatever at us, and then we'll try to make it work.
The thought really entered my head as I was watching it in terms of the environment, that with every role, there's the preparation and there's the intellectual side of it that comes into play. But especially when you're put in that environment, the instinctual has to kick in.
Yeah. All the intellectual stuff was before cameras were going, before anything, before even we were even close to principal photography. All that heady stuff, all the questions, all the intellectual stuff was done well before we started shooting. And then from there, it just became instincts.
Yeah.
And we made it best with what we had.
Tell me about Catherine Bigelow.
She's awesome.
Yeah.
She's, I was able to spend a year with her and Mark, talking about this role and this character and this film. And, when I went to train, it was on my own, and I got to share my experience. She invited me into this world, her film, and empowered me as an actor and as a human being to be the best I can be, because she trusted me. She didn't get in the way of me doing my job, and it helped her do her job. So she was so good about, making it feel like, even though she's the boss, she's the one in charge, it's her film, she's making it happen, but she certainly made it feel as if we all are in this together, as we were. And that collaboration that she gave to me was a wonderful gift.
Yeah. And yeah. I was also very excited about the movie, too, because you're one of my favorite actors, but another one of my favorite actors, Anthony Mackie, you're acting across from. Could you share something about him? He's fantastic, too.
He's so good, man. I mean, Brian Garrity as well. These two guys, I absolutely needed them as they needed me. We clung to each other because of the conditions we were in. They're both very smart actors. Anthony, I only met not until I got to Jordan, even though I was very familiar with his work and very excited to work with him. And then, you never know. Someone can be such a great actor, but can be very difficult to work with.
Mm-hmm.
He is smart, easygoing, wants to get the job done, make it the best possible, and he'll give everything he's got. And he did. And he brings it every moment, every take. The guy is a genius to me.
You're getting a lot of talk about this film and possible Oscar consideration and that sort of talk. Can you conceive of that at all at this stage?
No, man, I can't. I surround myself with the things that are real.
Yeah.
Things that, you know, I take it like moment by moment, and, you know, I'd be remiss to look into the future and not really focus on the moment in the present that's happening now, and feeling so blessed and so fortunate that this movie, first of all, getting seen,
yeah.
And before that it even got finished, and or even got made, really, and just, you know, that it's being well received, you know, awesome, that, you know, hopefully people go see it, fantastic. So I just kind of take it moment by moment and kind of just enjoy this road, because it doesn't come around very often.
Yeah.
So,
and it's the experience of it that means that is what means something. And after having gone through this experience, I'm curious how you feel you're a different actor, or how you've changed as a person, even.
You know, probably a lot. I mean, just from that experience, shooting the movie, coming back was very hard for me.
Yeah.
And but I certainly got to take away a wonderful experience of my awareness about EOD, my awareness as an ignorant American California kid about the Middle East, about, you know, Arabic Muslim culture. I wasn't sitting there like, oh my God, I'm skipping around, this is amazing, what a wonderful experience. But as I can now reflect, as I'm in my flip-flops and shorts in sunny California a couple years later, I'm like, that was an amazing experience. How lucky were we all to be able to do that?
Yeah.
But would I want to do it again? Probably not.
Yeah.
But I'm so glad I was able to do that, you know. And but it certainly shifted me as a person.
Yeah. Before now,
as an actor, like maybe as an actor, meaning I'll certainly look a little bit more intently on where it's being shot, or I don't think I have the physical and mental emotional strength to be able to do that again.
Right. Before I let you go, let me ask you about future projects. I saw Lightbulb at a recent festival.
Yeah.
I liked it very much.
Oh, cool.
So Lightbulb, is that on the horizon for release, and what else might be coming up for you?
No, I don't know. Last I heard, they're bouncing around doing the festival thing, probably still looking for some distribution. So not sure where that's gonna go, really. And as far as like another project, I'm just kind of waiting around. I'm being pretty picky anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm just kind of waiting for someone to bite at me and. And really, the decision isn't in my control. The decision comes down to the script that comes, you know.
Yeah.
Where there's not a decision to be made. It's like, oh, I have to do this.
Well, I will watch anything that you're in. I think you're one of our great actors, and I appreciate your time so much.
Oh, thank you, man. I really appreciate that.
Okay, that was Jeremy Renner, and
that was best interview that you've done, like one on one, in a long time. That was really good.
Well, thank
you. Really
you,
got
man.
A lot out of him.
thank you, dude. He's a great guy.
Really. Now, I do have a question. What were the sirens about, though? I mean, what was up with that? They were really loud. That was
I know.
Right nearby.
I think he's calling from the New York City or something, and he's stepping out since Sam Rockwell was giving him a hard time, so he was outside. we actually interviewed Jeremy once before. This was a year and a half or so ago in connection to a movie called Neo Ned.
That's right. We also, if I'm not mistaken, was that Gabrielle Union also?
Yeah, she came on. She was his co-star. She came on after him.
She was great. She was hysterical. And, I mean, the movie's not, but she was a very lively interview.
Yeah. But Jeremy talks a lot about Dahmer in that first interview,
mm-hmm.
too, so... And talk about a way to start a career with a role like that.
Yeah, in a movie like that. I mean, wow. That's not something you easily forget.
Yeah.
Whether you're watching it, or I would imagine whether you're acting in it.
But that was also a real statement of the kinds of roles that you could see him
mm-hmm.
taking on.
Right.
You know, not the easy route. Finding something that's so challenging... how do you make Dahmer sympathetic? I don't know necessarily that was the goal. I don't think you have to do that.
I mean, I remember when I first heard about the movie, God, this is 2002 or whenever, and I remember one of the reviews, like, compared it to Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
That it was like the Boogie Nights of serial killer films. I'll never forget that. And there's some truth to that, but...
But if you think about it, that was a... I don't know what kind of theatrical it got, but that was a movie that... There's lots of movies like that you find on your video shelves. It's a new trend. Ed Gein.
Yeah, I was just going to say, there's a whole... That's the one that stood out, though.
There's another Zodiac movie that came
yeah.
out before Fincher's
mm-hmm.
DVD. You know, kind of those kinds of movies. Dahmer is the only one you hear anyone talk about with any kind of reverence because
mm-hmm.
of Jeremy Renner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it is a part. I mean, you can... I guess it starts maybe with Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. I mean, not sympathetic. I mean, he's certainly not a sympathetic character. But if you can get an actor to inhabit that, to get that kind of character, and you can make them scary, truly terrifying, not just a cardboard cutout.
Yeah.
But like, and then like Rimmer does with Dahmer. I mean, it's not a cardboard cutout at all. Which the other films, I think we could honestly say they are that varying degrees of cardboard cutouts. But no, his Dahmer is something to be terrified of. At
mm-hmm.
times, so that's more power to him.
Yeah, and not just a simple monster, though.
Yeah, no. I mean,
yeah.
You know, they're, how should we say it? If played right, villains can be the most memorable part of the film, not just over the top, but you play, you know, you can just get so much out of it. It's always more fun to be the villain than the, you know.
Right. A few things have happened since we've been out. First of all, one thing in reference to the last show that we did, which was very exciting for us because it was Mike Medavoy, we were talking about something, a real kind of issue.
Yeah, we were.
With the way films permeate the culture throughout the world and how they represent the U.S. and the perception of us throughout the world. And a lot of issues came into play with that conversation, terrorism and that
mm-hmm.
whole thing. So that was a great conversation. Then we started discussing Michael Jackson's career with several of his collaborators.
Mm-hmm.
This is ironic for one big reason. I think Michael Jackson is a big story.
Yeah.
It certainly needs to be covered. I don't begrudge the airing of the memorial service, but at the same time, some major stuff has happened the past 10 days.
Yeah.
You know, and it's been trumped. So it's interesting how we started our show last Sunday with a discussion, movie-related, of course, on big world issues.
Yeah.
And then we went to Michael Jackson, and you could see that happening the past two
yeah,
weeks.
Yeah, no, but
news.
It's the best thing. Look who has benefited from the Michael Jackson government. The Iranian government, North
mm-hmm.
Korea. Although I think North Korea, it's really, he must hate it because it's taking attention away from him. He very much is like the character that they portrayed in Team America. I think he's really jealous of this whole thing. But, no, a lot of things have happened in the last 10 days. It is quite astounding what's happened.
We'll talk about some of it as it relates to movies. But this is, to go back to Sunday, this is what I've been doing. I've been trying to get the word out about our Michael Jackson interviews because there are a couple of bombshells that were thrown about Michael Jackson, but not gossipy bombshells, stuff that would be of interest to a movie fan. It's all movie related, which I was proud of because we're a movie show. We're not
We're not a gossip. We're not TMZ.
Although this
event did put them through the stratosphere.
So speaking of which, Blog Talk Radio and I worked in collaboration to get the word out, and a couple of newspapers news services in London and one in the U.S. just picked it up today about the interview that we did about Michael Jackson's movie career that never happened. But then we send it out to everyone, and I'm so wild about marketing, and I send out press releases to everyone. The AP, an AP writer, and the Associated Press provides the news all throughout the country.
Right.
An AP writer wrote an article where he talked about how Michael Jackson had no interest whatsoever in pursuing a career in film. I was like, that's completely wrong.
Yeah.
Wrong. So we called the writer, we tried to get, you know, we're trying to get this out there. And finally I got ticked off, and so I called TMZ you know, TMZ has a news tip line.
Right.
So I called them. This was interesting. I expected a recording, and somebody picked up the phone.
Oh, that's cool.
And I get real nervous in certain situations. So I started telling her about it, and she said, oh, that's cool. And she was conversing with me about it. My thought was, obviously, they're going for sensational news, but they need Michael Jackson news to fill up 24/7 because that's what they're doing. So maybe something even along these lines would be of interest to them as filler. I don't think they ran with it. But that's what we've been doing for the past 10 days. So we've been away from actually physically doing the show, but not working on the show necessarily.
Right, no. No, and it's important, actually. You just brought up a really good point about TMZ filling the thing, because a lot of the so-called 24-hour news networks don't have, it's not 24/7, it's a lot of repeats after midnight. I mean, it's not they're on the air. And it's always been something disheartening to me, because what's the point? I mean, MSNBC, we have it all weekend. The world could be coming to an end, but it's lockup or whatever that show is all weekend, or to catch a predator. So actually, TMZ, you know, really got, you know, really ran with this and for once was right, and it put them over the top. Because when I first saw that thing the day this happened, I mean, Farrah Fawcett was in the morning, and then I remember I was about to go to the gym, and I saw this thing that Michael Jackson was at the hospital. And I was like, but I saw TMZ, so I didn't really think much of it. And then an hour later, I was at the gym, and I saw all the news. I was like, holy shit, TMZ was right.
Yeah.
They were right, and they really, this thing has put them over the top.
Yeah, it really has, and everyone has benefited from I mean, that sounds cruel, but it's true.
The
news organizations.
That's the way the things work. That's the way the thing works. I mean,
and it really opens your eyes to the fact that the news business is a money business. And part of me thinks that news or networks should just swallow hard and know that they're going to lose money on their news organization. But it is their responsibility to deliver the news to Americans.
Right.
But it's become such a money-making machine like everything else. It's become capitalized.
Yeah, it's been like that for, I wouldn't like, probably the last 30, 40 years, I mean, but...
I don't know that it has. Because our gossip culture is not 40 years old.
No, but it's, you know, it's actually older than that, but I'm not talking about the news. I mean, as far as money goes, it's always been about making money in, like, with the advent of, like, CNN and, you know, the news and the news magazines. I would say from the 80s on.
Yes.
But
well, I would say probably
that,
so.
When you
and
had
it's just...
really good, when you had a really, when it was just the three networks, when you had the three, the evening news and that was it, then I think you have a legitimate case. It wasn't always about money because that's all you had. You had that in the newspaper and radio. But I would say, especially with the cable television, though, and now the Internet, it's all about money and trying not to lose your presence and your vitality because there's always someone just around the corner who's ready to take over if you drop.
Yeah.
So.
It's interesting. And you'll see Anderson Cooper or somebody, and they'll say, there are other things happening tonight. North Korea shot off 10 missiles. And I was like, or 7 missiles. I'm like, well, that's something. I mean, that's news, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that's big news. But but Michael Jackson, dude, was it yesterday? Yeah, that's all. If you wanted to get away with something, yesterday was the day to do it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the memorial service, just because of his Hollywood connection, and then we'll get into some things that we haven't talked about yet. Let's bring on Aaron. Aaron has a few things to say about the memorial and about some other topics we'll be discussing. Hey, Aaron.
Hey, guys. What's up, man?
What's up, man?
Good
what's
to be back.
Memorial. You watched it too, right?
Watched it. I watched it, and like I said, it was you know, I think I told you, Jamie, earlier, and that, you know, if you go back to the beginning of the memorial, in the opening, you know, there's some moments there when, like, certain, you know, people come out to speak, and, you know, the audience starts applauding. And it looked to me, I'm not judging the audience because I was that way also. You know, I think people thought, oh, this is going to be like a celebration, you know, like with some songs and dances and all that. But you quickly realize that it really is a, you know, memorial service, like a funeral, and it's very somber and very sad. And so even the musical choices, you know, they weren't the, you know,
yeah,
they weren't going to play the hits. And that would have been a little...
No, that would have been weird.
They weren't going to play Thriller with the zombies coming up behind.
Yeah,
yeah, they weren't going to do that.
They weren't going to do that. You know, so I thought it was actually good. In fact, I just read this a little while ago that apparently on her Twitter page, Mariah Carey apologized for her performance not being up to snuff.
Right.
And I actually think, and I agreed with a couple of commentators who said that she's been a little hard on herself because I really liked her performance because it was so kind of emotional and not perfect. And not,
you know, none of the performances necessarily were up to snuff. It wasn't about that.
Yeah, it really wasn't.
And I didn't mind that at all.
I think this is the province of American Idol, unfortunately, where I think a generation of music listeners have been trained, unfortunately, to think that the only good performance is a singer that hits every note perfectly and can really belt it out, when some of the best vocalists are the ones who don't have the normal voices and
yeah.
who don't always, you know, project properly. I mean, in the case, Bob
Dylan. Is that true? Is there really a generation? I mean, don't these people realize there's a difference between the studio and when you go out on the road? I mean,
if you go to these, you see the highlights even of these like American Idol tours. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's all about, you know, reaching the rafters, and you know, and that's why I detest American Idol, what it stands for. I mean, you know, I went to a Springsteen concert this year, my first one, and you know. I like that raggedness.
Well, I think your little pitchy dog is now part of the national language. So, so I think people take that with them.
That's interesting. I never even thought about that. You're absolutely right. I just never thought about that. Wow.
Well, it's actually, and there are very few performers, new performers now, with any kind of character. With any kind of distinction in their voices.
Mm-hmm. That's
no, like, life experience. There's no Tom Waits out there.
No,
there's only
no.
Tom Waits.
No,
there's no Leonard Cohen, but, you know, there's, and to give American Idol a little bit of its due, I think the best stuff Kelly Clarkson has done is when she got away from American Idol.
Yeah, it produces some talented people. Jerry, you're about to say something?
Yeah,
Tom Waits?
I just want, not just Tom Waits, who I love and admire, but it seems one of the things that a lot of commentators, a lot of op-ed pieces when talking about Michael Jackson is we live in an age now, as we're trying to explain to some people today, you are never going to be able to have, just the way the landscape is now, you are never going to have someone of superstardom level like Michael Jackson ever again, someone to sell that many units or whatever you want to use to describe it. I mean, it was like we live in such a fragmented, fractured environment. You know, everyone has their own little cluster and everything, and there's so many people trying to do what he did. And you have so many, you're never going to have, I think the era of the superstar might have closed last week with his passing.
Well, I think also in 82, certainly when he was a kid, and certainly in 82 when he really erupted, everybody couldn't be a celebrity.
Yeah.
You know?
You had to
be exceptional in some way.
Yeah. Now it's just, you know, you, like with anything, you get, you know, you can post a video on YouTube or get it, you know, you saw, I mean, anyone can do it. That doesn't mean everyone has talent, but everyone has the tools to do it.
Right.
And the thing about Michael Jackson, you know, and there are other, you know, there are other quote-unquote artists who have been quote-unquote more prolific, you know, had more albums, be it Bob Dylan or Springsteen
mm-hmm.
or Prince. And so therefore they might have more that you can savor. But I was always a Jackson defender artistically in that it is not an understatement to say that he was the biggest entertainer in the world. No other, not even then, and not, certainly not now, could someone, you know, change network programming because they want to debut the first video from their new album.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that does get on my nerves is I've noticed on the blogosphere, you know, when Sharpton and other people have said, you know, before Oprah was accepted or Obama and some of the later African American celebrities, Michael Jackson, you know, he crossed lines. And I agree with that 100%, and there have been some commentators who pushed back on that, on this insinuation that Michael Jackson had anything to do with civil rights, you know, liberties and so forth. And the thing is, okay, did Michael Jackson march in Alabama and get attacked by dogs? Okay, no. So he's not a civil rights leader in that way. But what he did in with the Thriller and the Bad in the 80s in getting people to, of all races, to embrace that music and look past color to such a global degree, no one has ever done and no one will ever do. So in that sense, he did contribute to civil rights progress, and that should not be undermined or, you know, undervalued what he did with them. And people like Bill O'Reilly and them are really, they're really showing their prejudices and, you know, I'll just say their racism.
Well, yeah, I'll give you that. I mean, yeah, Bill, whatever they call him, Billy or whatever.
Well, yeah, I watch Bill O'Reilly almost every night. I enjoy watching him. But tonight, I was telling Eric, tonight he said, to Al Sharpton, he said, how could Michael Jackson be an African-American icon if he had white kids? And I was like, what?
What? I got to say, that's just one of the dumbest things I've heard him say. And
that came out of nowhere. It's like, what do you mean?
But
what does
look,
that mean?
Go back to what Aaron was saying. When Thriller came out, I was in junior high school, and every white kid in America wanted to be Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
Okay, everyone, but
his
every
talent can't
person.
Be denied. But for me, the most talented entertainer, the most talented person that ever lived, in my concept of time, is Sammy Davis Jr. And Sammy Davis Jr. did it when racism was at its zenith.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
he broke those barriers. There wasn't the media then that there was for Michael Jackson to break through.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's a
and
good
Gary,
point, Sammy.
And Gary, you probably remember this, Gary, back in the day, in UT game, I guess, in that, you know, back in the day, you know, there was that whole divide of, you know, kids who, you know, who were into rock and metal and those who were into dance and disco. And there was that crossover. I mean, there were those, when Beat It came out with Eddie Van Halen, that got played on metal radio.
Yeah, I mean, well, there wasn't that much metal radio. I mean, and I am one of the kids you're talking about, the hard rock and metal, but before I listened to that music, you know, I listened to, like, the Stones, and, you know, when Thriller came out, everyone bought Thriller. I mean, didn't matter who you were. I don't care what, you know, whether you listen to the Dead Kennedys or the B-52s, everyone bought Thriller.
Yeah.
I mean, it was one of those things, like, any tape collection, any vinyl collection, anyone's house in suburbia, chances are they had Thriller.
You know, and I cried a lot. I actually cried a lot at watching the memorial yesterday because I'm a crybaby. But I thought it was very moving. But this is the element of this that fascinates me so much, and then we'll get on to something else. He's spoken with enormous reverence now, where for the past 16 years he's been thrown through the mud. Whether that's justified or not, I'm not commenting on that. But I guarantee you that a lot of the people that did throw him through the mud are jumping on the reverence wagon now.
Oh, yeah.
So what really fascinates me about situations like this is the shadowy morality of it, where, you know, there's the possibility of scandal, and you linger on that, or you choose to just ignore the vile things he was accused of, but he wasn't convicted of, and just hold him up in extreme reverence. So that interests me, the way that people go on this thing, because for 16 years he was a public enemy.
Which
brings about our next topic.
Yeah. Before we get to that, I just want to say, though, isn't that what we do even with, like, you know, performers that are alive that we do, like a film director or writer or anything, their beliefs or something? We separate the artist from the person, if that's possible. And there are some people we have to do that with because they're – maybe we don't agree with their political beliefs. Maybe they – you know, and we have to do that. Now, I realize with Michael Jackson – you're right. Before he – let's be very honest. Before he died – a lot of the people, I would say a good chunk of the people, well, people in the media, were probably make cracking jokes about him or whatever.
About everything.
Yeah.
About him becoming white, about all of that stuff. And now they're claiming him as, you
yeah,
know.
I mean, there's a huge, huge bout of hypocrisy here. But, you know, what can you do? People want to jump on the bandwagon.
But that being said, I think it's good to compartmentalize. I think you can separate the two. I think if you saw like Hitler, I'm not comparing Michael Jackson to Hitler. Maybe this is a bad one. But Hitler
don't
used to
use
be
the Hitler. Don't use the Hitler example.
Well, he used to be an artist, so if you looked at some of those art pieces and they were brilliant, would you not think that they were brilliant just because of what Hitler is known as now?
Let me just say this. I hate the Vienna School for not taking him, okay? The world would be completely different had they just accepted him.
People refuse to watch Scorsese movies after Last Temptation. I think that's completely their loss. You know, I don't understand how people can't compartmentalize the work, if you enjoy the work, from the person, if you denounce the person's behavior.
Yeah, that's a good point, Jamie.
I stopped watching Mel Gibson after Bird on a Wire. But that's totally different. Jamie, I got to ask you one question, then we can move on. Did Michael ever duet with Barry?
No. Michael Jackson, in the year that he won all the Grammy Awards for Thriller, and he went to the award ceremony with Brooke Shields and everything, he requested that Barry Manilow sing a medley of his songs to him.
Wow.
So Barry Manilow did that during the Grammy show. So he liked Barry Manilow. And Janet Jackson always fantasized about Barry Manilow when she was growing up. That was her crush.
Wow. I did not know that.
You know what's the funny
Your
thing?
Your Barry Manilow trivia back in the day.
The funny thing is I knew if I asked that question, you would have the question that Jamie would have the answer. I knew he would have the answer one way or the other.
Yeah, well, that's good, man. Shit, I learned another thing today. This is awesome.
There you go. We're all about scoops here.
Big scoops.
Speaking of big scoops, how about this Public Enemy thing? That's a big scoop of litter.
I'm locked out of the chat room.
Yeah, a lot of people are getting kicked off, and I apologize for that, guys. But
it's my fault.
Yeah, we'll blame it on Jerry.
Yeah, it's my fault.
So Public Enemies, all of us were, at the very best, I think, lukewarm about it, at least compared to our anticipation of it.
That's a good way to put it.
But to varying degrees. Aaron, you...
I'm guessing that I probably like it the most out of the panel. My when I came out, and when I say I like the film, I really do like the film. It is obviously no Heat, no Manhunter. And my tagline when I came out, when I told people, I said, well, it's Minor Man, but even Minor Man is still one of the better directed films of the year so far. So that tells you where it falls in the pantheon for me. And I was talking to a few people who'd also seen the film, we were talking about how much we liked it and, what was missing, though, what didn't work, what did work. And the thing that was most striking, and I started realizing that this is true of a lot of Michael Mann films, but it was the most, you felt it the most with this film, and that it doesn't have a first act, where, Heat doesn't have a first act. It just starts in the middle of this team already formed, and they're doing a job. And Miami Vice obviously starts in the middle of the action. And Public Enemy starts really in the middle of the action. But the problem is Public Enemies was a story that needed a first act. And the thing that I was telling Jamie earlier is that, one of the big themes in Michael Mann's films is the individual operator going up against an institution and either being marginalized or crushed by that institution. And the thing with John Dillinger is that there's two institutions that marginalize him, and we don't see the formation of either one. It happens literally off screen. We don't really see the formation of the FBI, which would have been fascinating to see, because as we know, Michael Mann loves details, so that would have been fun. Or more crucially, when John Dillinger in the story for the second when he breaks out of prison the second time in the film and he goes back to Chicago. And Frank Nitti tells him, like, look, you make $74,000 at one bank job. We make that in a day. You're bad for business, so you're not welcome in Chicago. And so even organized crime has marginalized John Dillinger. And it would have been interesting to see that formation of the gangsters basically saying, hey, we actually can make more money if we organize and work together as opposed to just being in all individual operated. So the formation of the institutions is the key thing that's missing.
That didn't bother me. But I want to elaborate on what Aaron brings up, a very good point about the organized crime thing, because Dillinger is really the last of these individual outlaws before it becomes gangsterism, becomes a corporation.
Yeah.
And in that sense, it would have been nice had, I think Michael Mann would have elaborated on that show, and Dillinger's way of doing things is on the way out.
And the other thing, but what I do love about the film is the way it goes from objective to subjective. When the film opens, we see Dillinger is a total in-the-moment kind of romantic, and the scenes and everything he sees is ideal for him.
Right.
Even the woman, played by Mary Cotillard, she's an idealized version of a woman. And so in those scenes, their first scenes together are composition-wise and dialogue-wise, they're played in a very old-fashioned Hollywood gangster romanticism. And so he puts Dillinger's in this kind of cocoon. And throughout the film, the real world kind of keeps puncturing, trying to burst his bubble, if you will, be it the FBI, or be it Babyface Nelson, or all the crime syndicate. They keep trying to bust his bubble. And as the film goes on, reality keeps crushing in on Dillinger's, his cocoon, really, to where by the end, in the last 20 minutes, which is spectacular, from the scene where he goes into the Chicago precinct on, the film is totally subjective. The camera is moving constantly and is literally on his ear at one point. And so Dillinger, by that point, has no illusions of what's going to happen to him. And the other interesting thing is that where at the beginning he was in a cocoon and the woman, Billy Fichette, was kind of questioning him, by the end of the film they've switched places. She's a romantic and he has no illusions about how his life is going to end. And so that was what I loved, the progression from objective to subjective throughout the film, in the way it's done visually. The camera is very still in the opening, but by the end it's all jagged all over the place. And the last thing I'll say is that I love the use of doubles, in that on the crime side you have Dillinger and Babyface Nelson, and Dillinger is presented as kind of he is a little more aware of his public enemy, and Babyface Nelson is a crazy person.
Mm-hmm.
And they get doubled by J. Edgar Hoover, who's kind of the Babyface Nelson doppelganger in Melvin Purvis. To the point, and Mann makes no qualms about trying to make parallels to modern times with the war on crime and the excessive use of torture, to the point that when Babyface Nelson dies, that's the real person they should be, publicizing that they got rid of. He was the true menace to people killing innocent people. But
that's true. But they also chronologically they fudge the facts in the film, not the book that it's based on, but they everything's out of order. I read
I read that too. But to me that. I've never gone into a film based, supposedly.
No. I'm just saying. I just want to bring that up. It is. They did like. I don't know why they did that, but yeah.
And it is unusual for Michael Mann to do that, since the devil's in the details for him,
But the thing is, the devil's in the details, but he's still a dramatist. And even something as quote-unquote detailed as The Insider, if you really go back and read that history, he combined events and did stuff on the internet.
I'm not using it as a criticism. I mean, for that I could care less about, because I realize, not everything, no film is historically accurate. But I was just, that did surprise me, though, that he took that, he played around with that.
Well, and he does it for a greater good. And to put as fine a point on it, and basically to bring it to modern times, is where Babyface Nelson, it's kind of Osama bin Laden, and they don't really care that they caught him. They're more interested of, to them, they want Saddam Hussein, and that's like the John Dillinger character. So they're kind of like, they're going after they're putting all their energies on the wrong person that they should be going after.
Well,
interesting analogy. I don't know. I think you're pushing it there, but that's I'm not going to say you're totally wrong, because they're desperate in the second half of the film to tie it in. to what's going on in the war on terror. They are grappling with that, I do feel. But that's interesting, Aaron. That's a good point.
And I think the one thing we all can agree is that it probably has, so far this year, the best sound design.
Well, that's his strength.
The technical is.
I walked out saying I love the sound of the gunfire.
Yeah.
And his movies are always technically they're gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't work, man. I mean, it has no life. It has no energy. It has nothing that engages you. I could give a shit about the backstory of the FBI, and I want to know these people. And there was no investment in these people. Now, there was in Heat and The Insider in his earlier movies prior to that. And he, because he expressed character through action during the movie, he didn't need backstory to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a troubling thing going on with Michael Mann in Miami Vice and this one, where we're seeing process, and we're not seeing character. And
when you mean process, what do you mean exactly?
And this is even a less of a process movie than any of his other movies, including Miami Vice.
You don't really see the process that much.
Yeah, but you're seeing. You're seeing them do what they do, but there's no emotional investment in who these people are. I'll give you a couple of examples. The end of it says Melvin Purvis died by his own hand in 1960. There's a title card. Why did you put that there? There was nothing that indicated that this character would do that. There was nothing to indicate who this character was to begin with. The performances, I think everyone is game in the movie, but you don't feel it. You just kind of watch it go by, and it's a beautiful thing, but you don't feel anything for it.
I think Depp, it's a great star performance by Depp. I think Stephen Graham.
I think it could have been a better star performance.
It could have been
if he would have been
better.
Written a character.
You see glimpses of it, like you said, Aaron, when he walks into the police station. That's a great scene. I think the only time these characters come to life, the two leads, that is, Christian Bale and Johnny Depp, is when they interact with the Billy Frechette character. She's the only one in the film who has any sort of intensity. Because I think she's
the high point in the movie.
Yeah, when she's not on the film is dead. I mean, it's an empty film, and I hate to say that, but it's empty.
I think the second half is better than the first half.
Oh yeah, I'll give you that, but that's not saying much in this case.
But the thing that I think, and the reason I think the second half to me is a little interesting is that he finally allows Bale, he gives Bale a little bit of screen time, and we get an inkling of a character that's there, particularly, and we realize there's a scene where they beat up Billy Frechette. And he's totally disgusted by it. And then there's that great moment where he carries her.
That's the only time he comes to life in the film.
And that's emotional.
That's
everything else is intellectual. To put it a different way, these characters aren't characters. They're functions. That's what I felt watching.
Well, and the fact that this is man's, I think, probably since Mohican, this is man's shortest film, and frankly, you know, we talk about Heat, we talk about Insider, Ali, even Miami Vice. I mean, those things are over 2 hours long.
I think Collateral shorter, but oh.
And Collateral works because it's just two people, and so it has a pulpier vibe to it. So, but this has this has good 10, 12 characters, and frankly, it's crying out for at least an extra half hour.
I tell you what it's crying out for, and this is why Michael Mann is, and I told this to you, Jerry,
mm-hmm.
Michael Mann is the perfect director for it in that it's gangsters, law enforcement, it's Chicago, it's violence. He's absolutely the wrong director for it because in order to make this work as it should have, he would have had to have made it a sequel to Heat, and he wasn't going to do that.
No, the
movie begs for that kind of involvement and investment in both sides of the spectrum and how they complete each other in a way.
I would probably agree with it. I do feel what I've read in some interviews, and Michael Mann has not come out and said this, but if you read between the lines, what is going on is that really, right now, anyways, the studios aren't going to let him do that epic. He's having to get shorter and shorter and be more compact, and I think it's sort of it's truncating his vision. And that's the problem. I mean, they're not willing to bankroll a 3-hour, period gangster film. They're just not willing to. I almost think Michael Mann, even though every time he goes it gets canceled, real quick. But he needs to. This is the perfect time with his obsession with HD to go to an HBO or to go to an FX and do another series. I think the time is right where a Michael Mann series would finally catch on.
Yeah,
that's a good point. I have to say though, I think the most disappointing aspect of the film is that there's no link. There's nothing between the two men. Whereas in the Milius film between Warren Oates and Ben Johnson, I got a very clear relationship, antagonism between the two men. There are actually scenes with them together, or You got more of the process, if you would, in that film than you get in this film, which I find ironic because, Michael Mann is all about the process. But I get nothing. I get no reading on what makes these two men tick in this film. There's nothing inside, and I think that's what's so aggravating is you have these two very talented actors who can do anything, and they, as you say, Jamie, they are game for it. Everyone is, but they're just not given anything to do.
I think you get more of a sense of what makes Dillinger tick than, I mean, the one who gets short shrift is Christian Bale.
Oh, big time.
He gets short shrift, and he's a better variation of Elliot Ness than the cloying Kevin Costner version. The reason why, quote unquote, the Kevin Costner character, if you will, work is because it's so clean and so goody, pure that it's there's no dimensions to it. But the fact that Bale and Mann are trying to insinuate that there's something a little more to this guy, but they don't have enough screen time to show it, it feels shortchanged.
He does get very shortchanged in this. There's no doubt.
There's another news story that just occurred a couple of days ago that involves a movie, a very good movie, and that movie is called The Fog of War, and that's a Errol Morris film. It's one of his best. It's the one I enjoy watching the most,
yeah.
I think. That is just a sit-down interview with Robert McNamara, and Robert McNamara is widely reviled and known, infamous for being the main architect of the Vietnam War.
His war.
Yeah. That's always what was put on him. And, of course, it's more complicated than that, as you'll see if you watch the movie. But he passed on a couple of days ago, I think.
He passed on Monday at 93. Another guy who benefited from Michael Jackson's death. No, I'm not. Dude,
yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
Let me say, I need to talk, because I've talked to so many different people and read so many different things. Robert McNamara is reviled by people who grew up during the Vietnam War, people whose spouses and sons and children died in the Vietnam War, and that you can't argue with him there. I mean, McNamara, is responsible for this war. But if you read the Errol Morris blog on the New York Times today,
yes,
he says something that is very important. And yes, I mean, McNamara did all these, and it took him a long time to turn around, and even a lot of people felt that was, self-serving or whatever. But when he came into the Pentagon, he said, those guys were the biggest hawks in the world, and they had plans, a first strike plan for the Soviet Union. They wanted to very badly launch we always had a larger nuclear arsenal than the Soviets. And he wanted to change that. He didn't want this. He basically, in one sense, kind of saved civilization, in this weird way, by changing that atmosphere.
Right.
That, but We do have.
But that
Vietnam.
Will not be his. That is not his legacy.
No, his legacy will always be Vietnam. But it's interesting. I was happy that Errol Morris brought that up, though.
Yeah, and it's brought up. It's the first one of the first segments in the movie too.
Yeah.
And they also discuss Hiroshima and.
They said if they lost, they would have been tried for war crimes. If
yeah.
we lost the war, I would never forget that. He said him and Curtis LeMay, they would have been, like, tried for war crimes.
And he said we probably should have been.
Yeah.
He's a complicated guy. And what I what I appreciate about it, though, no, because it's more than he lived in complicated times. He's a complicated guy.
That's what I mean.
Bush and Rumsfeld live in complicated times. They're not complicated people. This guy he grappled with it for a long time. People wanted to hear "I'm sorry, I was wrong" from him, and he gave them, I think, something better, something more. But he never said those words, "I'm sorry, I was wrong."
Right,
and
the
that's
he doesn't. The reason I love the film, he doesn't do that because he knows that that's a minor concession.
Yes.
And also, what is interesting, and as much as he tries to, in the film, through his explanation, kind of quote, this is the wrong word, but lack of a better word, he tries to explain and rationalize his decisions.
Mm-hmm.
What Morris does through his editing is to go back to that archive footage of those sound bites where he is very gung-ho and assured. And basically, Morris, through his editing, doesn't let McNamara off the hook.
Oh, no, not at all.
And doesn't let him, even in this present sense, in this present day when he's filming him, even though, McNamara has changed and he's got these new views, Morris basically through that editing is saying, okay, that's good, and it's good we got this on record, but we are not going to forget what you did in your youth. Is really what he's doing.
Well, and plus, but at the same time, he's a good filmmaker because you feel what he felt while confronting McNamara about this stuff, because there were times when he thought to himself, am I not pushing hard enough, or am
right.
I pushing too hard? You feel that within yourself.
Right.
You feel that tortured kind of empathy with McNamara.
And
that's the power of the film.
Yeah.
I want to say for our listeners who are going to see Fog of War, and they should see Fog of War, and it's obviously Errol Morris's most commercial film, it won the Oscar and all that, if they have to see another one, there's so many to choose from, but I would recommend Mr. Death.
That's a good one.
That one is just, talk about not able to resolve your feelings.
Yeah. Very good point, Aaron.
That's a great, and it's almost a black comedy. It's so
He's insane. Fred Lucker is an insane
sick
puppy. But going back to McNamara, though, it's like he will always be associated with this. There will never be, as you read the obituaries, read the op-ed piece, even the op-ed pieces of people defending him, which are, and the other ones not still going after him, not letting them off the hook. It's interesting, though, he does let up and obviously, there seems to be some conflicting stories about this, but he did go to Johnson and saying, this is, we got to stop. And it was Johnson who wanted to. Johnson took full control of the war and sent all these troops in. And, he's not just McNamara. There's a whole chorus of people here to blame. But McNamara is the main architect, but there's a lot of blame to go around.
And there's tape recordings of him talking to Kennedy.
Yeah.
And him saying to Kennedy, We got to think of pulling out. I mean, we got to think of starting to pull out of an exit strategy.
Yeah, and it seems like the neoconservatives and everything took all the wrong lessons from the best and the brightest. They thought this was right, and it's very interesting how Vietnam is always considered called the liberals' war, and then we get the Iraq War, which is the conservative Republican, the first big war done on the Republican watch. So it's a very interesting compare and contrast of those times and how people are duped once again.
There's no proper segue for this.
We'll just do it then.
For Vietnam and McNamara. To Entertainment Weekly's ranking of the top 40 Woody Allen films. I can't think of a proper segue. Sorry. They're both old guys.
Talk about separate. Never mind.
So we have their ranking in order of their presumption of quality. Top 40. How many do we want to go through?
I don't have the list in front of me, so...
All right, let's do top 10. That's a nice even number.
Okay.
And we can debate. They say that the 10th best Woody Allen movie is The Purple Rose of Cairo.
10? I don't know, but it is a near perfect film.
It's a great film. I can't think of anything wrong with that one.
I do love Woody Allen's quote when he was asked, I think at the time or a little shortly after it came out, they're like, "Why didn't you go with a happy ending?" He's like,
"Yeah,
I thought I did."
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it is happy. It is. What the hell?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. Number 9, Sleeper.
I would actually put, 20 years ago, I would have put that a lot higher.
Sleeper, I do have a tremendous... I think that was my... Might have been my first or second of, like, quote-unquote, the funny Woody Allens I saw. And I remember the first time I saw it, and there are stretches where I was uncontrollably laughing.
Oh,
I hurt. I got dizzy. The fight with the pudding and the big suit that he's
mm-hmm.
blown up, those two sequences are just two of the funniest scenes ever.
It's physical comedy. I mean, it's odd... It's an odd kind of Woody Allen movie in that it relies more on the physical comedy than
it
does.
Oh, but it has the best last lines of any of his films.
Yeah.
I mean,
but
you got to
admit, it's there are long stretches where there's no dialogue, where it's
all
physical.
I know, but dude, the movie's hysterical. Even by today's, oh man, that movie's hysterical. All right, what's
number 8? 8 is, by the way, I completely disagree with most of the rankings of these movies.
Oh, I don't go by Entertainment Weekly, but yeah, go with number 8.
Number 8 is Zelig.
See, Zelig is one of those art installations. I admire it, but it's not one of my favorites. And even at its, I guess, 72-minute runtime, that's a perfect runtime, and I think it's maybe a little long by 2 minutes. I admire the
a little long by. I remember seeing this in the theater. Okay?
It's long by 2 minutes. That's great. I felt those 2 minutes.
I felt those 2 minutes. I remember as a kid. Yeah.
Couldn't you have cut off those closing credits?
God damn you, Alan!
It's a technical achievement, and he probably should have won. It probably should have won Best Editing because the feat that it did in a pre-CGI world is pretty spectacular, but
it's an interesting concept, and very bravely rendered.
It has some great moments. I remember we used to go. I mean, there was a theater, the Avalon. It's still here, but I mean, we used to go see. I remember. I think I saw every Woody Allen film, like in the late 70s and the early 80s there. And I remember seeing. We went to see Zelig, and yeah, I don't know if I'd put it that high up there though.
Technically a marvel, but I mean it doesn't stay with you. Interesting to note, a summer release.
Yeah.
There was a time when Woody Allen films were summer releases.
Well, they stumped.
Number 7, What's Up Tiger Lily?
What?
Yeah.
I'd put Casino Royale before that.
Number 6, Match Point.
Wait, What's Up Tiger Lily? You gotta be What the fuck? Oh my! All right. I mean, it's a funny movie, but it was re-released as a joke, really. Okay.
Number 6 is Match Point.
I agree with that. That is a top. I think that is a top 10.
I want to see what comes after that. Then I'll go back to Match Point.
Number 5, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex, But Were Afraid to Ask.
No.
I tell you what.
Can
though.
I do my Chris? No. No.
Yeah. Exactly. One of the best sequences. Or one of the best segments of a Woody Allen film is that Gene Wilder. That's classic.
Some of his finest work.
Yes, that is amazing. And there is a full like minute long. And if we just sit here for a minute in complete silence, which we do often, you know how long a minute can feel. That minute long double take from Gene Wilder when the guy comes in there and says that he has sex with his sheep.
in the Michael Jackson issue?
No, it's online, I think.
Oh, it's online. Okay.
Yeah, it's online. It's preview. It's weeks ago.
God damn it.
That's classic. But I wouldn't put it in the top 10. Number 4 is Hannah and Her Sisters.
Okay, finally we're on top.
I would put that, actually, for me, as an adult, number 1.
Really?
Yeah. Tied with Love and Death. All right? If that's just... Sleeper.
I love Hannah and Her Sisters. This is my it'd be in my top 10. It would be. But.
Number 3 is Bananas.
Dude, who put this list? Did one of the editor's children make this list?
This is Owen.
Owen did this?
Yeah.
Aaron, you got to talk to him, man.
I'll talk to him.
Okay. Bananas? I like Bananas. Don't get me wrong. I think Bananas is a very funny movie. But you're going to put that ahead of Hannah and Her Sisters? Oh, God, what's number 2, Jamie? Just do it now.
Well, but yeah, I don't think that... I think this is the common consensus with Woody Allen, these top 2. Number 2 is Annie Hall.
Yeah, I mean...
And number one is Manhattan.
Yeah, okay, all right. I mean, I thought they were going to put, like, Small-Time Crooks or something at the rate they're going. I mean...
Well, the thing in my top 10 Woody Allen is, I mean, Annie Hall, Manhattan, Hannah, Max Point, those are obviously on my list, but then... You know, I'm the 1-2 punch of Everyone Says I Love You and Deconstructing Harry.
Deconstructing Harry would definitely be in my top 10.
And, I think Everyone Says I Love You. It's light as a feather, but truly profound romantic film. And
he doesn't have everyone. No, he has Everyone Says I Love You at number 29.
Where's Crimes and Misdemeanors?
Crimes and Misdemeanors, which incidentally would be my number 1.
I would be up to close to mine, man.
And Vicky Cristina would definitely be in the top 3 for me. Crimes and Misdemeanors for him is number 11. Small Time Crooks, which I think is the last truly hysterical movie that he made.
I'll give you that.
Underrated film. That is,
yeah, I think it's hysterical. It's number 15 for him. Right in front of Deconstructing Harry. And let's not forget about Bullets Over Broadway, which is 17.
I like that one a lot.
Sweet and Lowdown, which is 18.
Mm-hmm.
Husbands and Wives is 21.
I might move that up, Husbands and Wives.
I would too, yeah.
And I'm a staunch defender. The second Woody Allen film I ever saw in a theater, and it's still one of my favorites, is the Eric Romare-ish Manhattan Murder Mystery.
And oh, I like Manhattan.
I like that too. That's a good
and
one.
The reason I consider it kind of Eric Romare-ish in that it's not a hysterically funny film, although there are some hysterically funny things in it. But I look at it as two things. One, as Woody Allen's one of the things that he does in that no one ever talks about is that is a film where the couple at the beginning are together at the end. And that is a very hopeful film, oddly enough, and is actually one of the best portraits of a healthy, long marriage.
He has Manhattan Murder Mystery at number 30. There's very few Woody Allen movies. I mean, especially when you look at how many he's made,
yeah,
percentage-wise, that I don't enjoy. He has the bottom five or so. He has Shadows and Fog at 36, Hollywood Ending at 37, Celebrity at 38, Anything Else at 39, and number 40 is September.
I would put Celebrity a lot higher. I actually think that's an underrated film.
Celebrity is one of those interesting films. It to me, it doesn't work, but the stuff with Judy Davis, and particularly the 10-minute sequence with Leonardo DiCaprio, is classic Woody Allen.
Oh, yeah, but Judy Davis, he just gets incredible work out of. I mean,
anything else is probably actually a little underrated.
No, oh, yeah, I don't like that. But
I don't know, underrated, but it is one of the few films where he deals outright with anti-Semitism, so I have to give him points for that, where he actually, for one of the few times in his life, actually deals with anti-Semitism.
Now, another one of my top 5 Woody Allens, which a movie nobody talks about, and he actually has it at number 34, is Another Woman.
That of his Bergman-esque films, that's probably the
best. That's a good. I haven't seen that in a long time, but that is a good film.
I prefer that way over
Interiors,
which I can't. It's just terrible. And to me, the worst Woody Allen film that I've seen, I think there's a couple I have not seen, but is probably Jade Scorpion.
Yes.
I mean, that's his work.
Yeah, it's not.
He ranks Jade Scorpion over another woman.
Jade Scorpion's pretty, for no other reason than the fact that Helen Hunt cannot, she has no comic timing in that film.
It's a dead on arrival.
It's not a good film. It's a really
and
bad
Hollywood,
film.
Hollywood ending is also probably pretty bad. I will give Owen this in that he's one of the few people who is supporting whatever works as a misunderstood Woody Allen film.
He puts it at number 28.
Yeah, I got it. I saw Whatever Works last week.
He says people, the critics who are trying to come, you know, they're putting it, comparing it, holding up against, you know, Hannah, Manhattan, Annie Hall.
That's the wrong. It's the wrong way to look at it.
What did he call it? He goes, imagine a restoration comedy with the lead as the lead played by Howard Stern.
It's not that. I don't think it's that. I think you have to look at it as a film that was really supposed to be made in the 70s. And if you look at it like that, you see obviously where there are shades of Crimes and Misdemeanors and Hannah and Her Sisters to come. You see where the seeds of that germinate. But I think the thing is, I do like Larry David, but he is somewhat of a different beast than Woody Allen in many regards. God, can you imagine both of them if they both starred in the film? Oh, my God.
Yeah, that'd be too much angst.
No, but here's the thing. It's Dick. He wrote it specifically for Zero Mostel, and you keep thinking of this like it's a very 70s-era film. I mean, there's some modern references into it, but this is a dated film.
Can we all agree that the worst Woody Allen surrogate is Kenneth Branagh?
I don't know about that.
I thought that was.
I think Christina Ricci might be the worst, but
It's debatable.
Yeah,
Kenneth Branagh is the poster boy for the leading man imitating Woody Allen.
The best one, surprisingly, I'm surprised he didn't do more, was John Cusack.
Yeah, it's Cusack.
He was very good in Bullets Over Broadway. Very good.
Meanwhile, EW reviewed Bruno. Do you know what Owen?
Yeah.
A minus. Owen gave it an A minus.
So that gives me a little bit of hope. I was really kind of neutral on Bruno. But Owen gets an A minus, so now I'm a little more open to it. I'm a little more hopeful. And the fact that Armand didn't like it, I'm even more hopeful.
Oh, his review's up too?
Yeah, it's scathing.
And Lisa gave Hump Day an A minus. And Hump Day is very good. And we'll have people from Hump Day on Sunday night.
And I'm excited she gave I Love You, Beth Cooper a B+. And I'm cautiously optimistic about that film.
Wow. So there's some good choices.
Maybe there'll be finally some good films to see this weekend.
Yeah, because I did that top 10 list last night on the other show, and it was hard going, man.
Come on, you can call it. Say you were on Oscar. Don't call it that other show. That other show. The show that will not be named.
Yeah.
So what did you have as your favorite film of the year so far, which I know is inaccurate because you haven't seen Adventureland, but go ahead.
No, Adventureland is one of the best films of the year, no doubt.
I haven't seen Star Trek or Hangover. I chose Up as my number one.
That's a good choice, man.
I chose The Burning Plain as my number two.
Adventureland is my favorite film of the year still so far this year.
I got to agree with you, man.
That is an amazing film, and I can't wait for the DVD because that's when it'll finally get its cult status and it'll become the new Say Anything, Dazed and Confused of this generation. I try not to get cynical the fact that it came out the same week as Fast and Furious.
It wasn't that, man. It was one of the worst marketed films I've seen in a while. It was really poorly marketed.
I'm waiting for people to come up to me and like, you know, I just saw this movie on DVD, you know, Adventureland. It's really, I was like, yeah, that's a great film. How come I never heard of it? I was like, probably because you were going to the goddamn Fast and Furious movie that weekend. And I'm optimistic about upcoming wise. I'm optimistic about 500 Days of Summer and.
Oh, that looks incredible.
And Funny People. I think I get more and more I see the trailers, the new trailer for Funny People, I'm more and more excited.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, I think there's some promising movies up, but I'm very cautious.
I'm becoming more and more cautious after last week.
We got Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah, we got Shutter Island.
I'm toning down my expectations for that, and it's still one of my most eagerly anticipated movies, but I'm dialing down, as they say.
I don't think Shutter Island will disappoint us.
I don't think so.
I can't imagine that it would, looking at the trailer.
Don't say that. Don't say that, man.
What else was on your top 10? Did you have any of the documentaries? Tyson, Every Little Step?
You know what? No. No. And that was a complete misread on my part. Because I would have had them on. I would have certainly had Every Little Step on.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought Tyson was phenomenal. But
Tyson, did you have Taken?
I had Taken on there, yeah.
Taken. Look, we're getting, by the way, Taken too. Take some more.
By the way, did you guys know, Aaron, you read the books, I'm sure,
but
it was just a little line in the Hal Ashby book. Dustin Hoffman always wanted to work with Ashby, and they were friendly, and they were going to collaborate several times. You know about the Tootsie thing, Jerry,
right.
But
yeah.
The one thing that I thought was very odd was Hoffman wanted to do, was mulling over with Ashby, a sequel to Kramer versus Kramer that they were calling Kramer 2 or K2, where he and his son move in with a divorced woman with a Down syndrome child. That was going to be the plot of it.
And that that script got reworked and it turned into Rain Man.
Yeah.
Sounds like a Farley Brothers movie.
That's just it. That had to be one of the oddest projects I've ever read about.
When you said Kramer 2 or K2, I was like, really? They're going to go mountain climbing?
Right. Michael Biehn was in it. It was great.
Did you see that? Did anyone see that other than me?
K2?
Yeah.
It has a great opening. I will say that. It has a great opening.
I remember K2. I remember I was working Show East,
mm-hmm.
and I got to see 13 Days like a couple of months before it came out, and that was, wow, what a treat.
What a treat.
Can you tell my sarcasm?
What a treat.
I like that. You don't like 13 Days, man?
I was making a joke. I think it's partially very solid and partially horrendous. But they were
talking about that movie the other day.
You don't like Kevin Costner's life?
No, I think he's the horrendous part. But I met Brett Ratner that year because he was premiering Family Man or something.
Yeah.
And
they
played K2, and you know it felt like a useless kind of genre movie. But I never saw it. So who did K2?
It was some
Martin Campbell or something. That was
Vertical Limit.
Okay. See, it's one of those. It's one of those that all get mixed in.
You're thinking of Vertical Limit. K2. That's spring of '92.
Yeah, that's in 1992. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how, and Michael Biehn, back when Michael Biehn was thought he was still the shit.
I'm not going to tell him he's not.
I'm not going to tell him.
Is there another?
You saw The Abyss. I'm not going to tell him. No way. I'm not going to tell him.
I saw The Abyss. That was 3 years earlier. I love the Michael Biehn story of refusing to use his likeness on Alien 3 that summer.
That's right.
Then we're going to pay him. And he says, if I had known David Fincher was going to be David Fincher, I would have let him use it for free. He goes, so my bad.
My bad. Michael Biehn really said my bad.
Yeah.
I believe it.
Gotta love the Biehn, yeah.
Is there another movie story that interests you guys? Casting, movie story, anything?
And this is not from a reliable source, Ain't It Cool News. Cameron Diaz from Cato?
Yeah. It's being reported, for the Green Hornet movie, yeah.
Wow.
And I just, I don't know what to... what to make of it?
Well, make of it what you will.
I don't know what to make of it either. This is the first I'm hearing about it.
I don't know anything about Green Hornet. I don't know. I know Seth Rogen lost a lot of weight for it.
He looks good, man. He looks good for that. I mean,
he hates people asking him about it.
Yeah, I would too. I mean,
yeah.
We don't have to worry about that, Jerry.
What? About asking about being in the Green Hornet?
Asking how you're losing your weight.
No, I get that all the time.
Yeah.
I get that all the time.
Jamie, how's your weight program going?
It's been a great show, guys.
There you go, dude. There you go, Jamie. Very good. Very good.
Yeah. We'll be back Sunday night with some good people, including the cast and the director of Hump Day. And another big booking I'm waiting to hear about. So tune in Sunday night. It'll be
just
good.
Tune in. It's the most fun that you can have Sunday, so just tune in. Don't worry about the other booking. Just tune in.
Right, right. Guys, it's been a lot of fun.
All right.
I'm going to go watch K2.
You enjoy that.
I'm going to watch 13 Days and marvel at Kevin Costner's light Irish accent better than his Robin Hood accent.
And I will watch The Family Man. So we'll complete the showy cycle from...
Talk about a trilogy of terror.
17 years ago. All right, guys. Man, right. 17 years. God, time flies.
Yeah, it does.
Time flies when you're watching bad movies. What?
Yeah, it does. All right, good night, everyone.
Good night, guys. See you
good
Sunday
night.
Thank you.